So, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. People keep coming from the long lunch break, and I would like to welcome you now instead of Morgan's Sandfair. So, my name is not Morgan Sandfair. I'm Wolfram Horstmann, and I'm chairing the session this afternoon about research for information or information for research. So, we try to tackle the issue of how information can be provided to research, but also how research on information can be performed. And the first speaker is definitely speaking about the latter aspect, how information on research can be performed, or research on information can be performed. And I'm very glad that Martin Hoffmann-Apicius came here to speak about some developments in the biomolecular bioinformatics domain in relation to text mining. Martin has been, since 2002, the head of the Department of Bioinformatics at the Fraunhofer Institute for Algorithms and Scientific Computing in St. Augustine, and since a couple of years also appointed as professor for Applied Life Science Informatics at the Bonn-Aachen International Center for Information Technology. And I think, the floor is yours, Martin.
So, thanks, Wolfram, for the kind introduction. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me, giving me the chance to talk to you today. What I intend to do is take you on a trip, how use of scientific information may look like or may come across in the near future, hopefully not too far future. So I will talk about direct use and uptake of scientific information from scientific text and usage and modeling simulation in the life sciences. This is where I come from, the Fraunhofer campus in St. Augustine, where I'm part of the Algorithms and Scientific Computing Institute, and we are linked to the University of Bonn, as Wolfram already pointed out. Now, talking about direct uptake of information extracted from scientific text in modeling and simulation in life sciences basically describes how we make use of information that lives in text, typically for in silico experimentation. The underlying paradigm change that we currently witness in the life sciences has some phenotypes. One is certainly that we've seen with the omics, the genomics and proteomics and so on paradigm, an increase in the number of a flood of data and an increase in the number of publications, which ultimately lead to a situation where a single researcher is not able anymore to keep track with all the relevant and the related literature anymore. It's simply not possible to read 50,000 papers, but 50,000 papers is what exists on P53, a tumor suppressor gene. Moreover, in the life sciences, we observe that everything is somehow connected, so it's hard to discuss genetics just as a subdiscipline alone in its own without touching base with molecular biology or biochemistry, pharmaceutical chemistry and organic chemistry. All that somehow is connected and related. On the other side, we see that in biology and chemistry and medicine, there's a trend to more and more turn them into the quantitative sciences, which basically means that ultimately, biological processes are described by mathematical formulas. And once you can do that, and you have mathematical representations of biology or chemistry, you can use that in simulation, in silico experimentation. And I give you an example which comes from our own work, which is virtual screening. So you know screening for drugs, probably from the pharma industry, and you know that in pharma industry people have an assay, which is, a test that tests for the binding of a compound like Viagra to the target of Viagra, which is the PDE5 protein, or the compound like aspirin binding to the cyclooxygenase protein. So typical small molecule binding to a large protein. And actually, that can be done and simulated in the computer. What I show you here is a mathematical computer representation of a protein here and the pocket that binds the small molecule that can be either done by calculating the force fields that contribute to the binding of the small molecule into the protein, or you can do this in a discrete fashion and compute the interaction points where the small molecule in this binding pocket here interacts with the protein. This is what happens when you swallow actually a drug and it goes through your intestine and stomach and intestine and through your blood circulation to the target organ. And ultimately, such a small molecule here binds in this protein. This colorful thing here is a typical way to represent the protein. And then in the pocket, it is somehow trapped, and there it blocks the protein function, for instance, or modifies the protein function. And that is how a drug works, and that can be simulated in the computer. And when you do that with hundreds of thousands and millions of compounds, then you do a virtual screening. You look whether this interaction can work or not. We have done that 3 years ago on the world's largest scientific compute infrastructure, which is the EGE grid. And that has hundreds of computers, and those computers are clusters, so you have thousands of CPUs connected worldwide. And we have done millions of these simulations, millions of compounds into a couple of target molecules that are expressed by the Plasmodium falciparum, the parasite that is responsible for malaria. And it would have taken us on a single computer 80 years to compute that, and we did it in 2 weeks. Yeah? That's called e-science, so we distribute the compute problem. However, when you look at this scientific problem that we addressed here, this was a rather physical scenario because we had this virtual representations of chemical compounds and positioned them into the binding pocket of virtual representations of proteins. And simulation was easily doable in that setting, but the biology and medicine and chemistry are highly descriptive. And most of biology and medicine and chemistry is not accessible to this simple representation as in mathematics or as a computer model. So typically in physics, and when you drive a car, this car has been crashed 1,000 times against the wall in the computer, not physically. Yeah, that would be too expensive. So simulation is quite established in physics and engineering, but in biology, pharmaceutical chemistry, and medicine, most of what we know is somehow living in text, and it's also very complex, much more complex than the stuff these guys deal with. So how do we make use of the wealth of knowledge that is out there in the scientific literature? Now, the question fundamentally is, how do we get access to the knowledge that is in the literature, and how can we model it? And I would like to give you now a couple of examples of work that has been done by students of mine, that all starts with text mining. Because these objects here, cells, chemical compounds, proteins, and so on, gene protein names, they all exist in this text. They are all out there. It's more difficult to get hand on them than just querying a database of proteins or a database of gene sequences, because here are much more relationships in this text than you have in a database. But we, and of course a really strong community in the life sciences, have been developing text mining technologies for now more than 5 years. I think this goes back actually 10 years now, that people started to work on machinery that reads text for the scientists, because, as I said in the beginning, nobody can read all that flood of relevant text anymore. And we have developed ProMiner. This is this machinery. This is a reading machine for biomedical text. It's a named entity recognition machinery, which is aware of synonyms, acronyms, and all that. It resolves all the problems that come along with various usage of synonyms. Wherever we can map this to a reference object, we do. And wherever we have such a reference object, we typically have also a database entry. So whenever a gene or a protein is mentioned, we map it to a database entry in a genome database. We've also developed a software that reads chemical images, because one of the biggest problems in chemistry is that chemists love to communicate through images, through drawings, and not through text. If you look at a chemical formula representation in text, it's really awful, typically, unless it's a trivial name like Viagra. And then we have generated, for the ease of use, SkyView, which is a text mining environment for end users. And this is how it looks like. And if you're interested, you can demo it live later on. It's just here in this example, we use it to define a corpus, everything around Alzheimer. And the question I'm asking the system here is, give me all the genes that are highly relevant in Alzheimer. And I just define the subcorpus, and here I detect with this, I detect all the genes and proteins that are mentioned in the literature in a significant way and connected to Alzheimer. And this ranking here is done based on the Kullback-Leibler divergency, which is a rather simple statistical approach to ranking. But it's quite effective, actually. When we compare this to a typical review of genetics of Alzheimer or genetics of intracranial aneurysms or so, people actually come up with the same list of top-ranking proteins. Moreover, we have developed not only for genes and proteins, but also for all other types of biomolecules, mutations, chemistry, drugs, allelic variances, and so on. We have developed named entity recognizers for almost all relevant biomedical and chemical entities. And that is highly specialized. That is far from what you have seen in those previous talks with the lemmatization and so on. We are not going after a general purpose recognition machinery or indexing machinery for terminology, for any terminology. We're just addressing specifically the issue of biomedical terminology and chemical terminology, and you need really dedicated and specialized solutions for that. There is no solution from the, let's say, newspaper domain that you can apply here. Namely, all the terminology systems that I know outside of our domain are not aware of the synonym in gene names, for instance. Typical human gene name has at least 10 different names. But typical human gene has at least 10 different names. So we link out from a reference entry to from the text, we link out to a database, in this case here the NCBI database, which holds the information on the gene sequence and so on, a lot of useful information, and that actually increases the information content in scientific text quite dramatically, because you add a lot of further attributes to the object that is mentioned in the text. Now, this is basically what we have done on the technology and enabling side. Now I show you how we're using it. And the first thing is a master thesis of Harsha Gurulingappa, an Indian student in my group, who has used text-based information for the prediction of pharmaceutical activities of drugs. And the goal of this study was developing a method for predicting putative ATC classes. ATC is a classification system for pharmaceutical drugs. And there's about less than 50% of the drugs that we have on the market are classified in the ATC classification. And there's more than 50% which are not yet classified. But they are mentioned in scientific text. And we want to develop basically a new paradigm for strategies aiming at identifying potentially secondary applications for existing drugs, because it turns out that a lot of drugs are having positive side effects, not only negative, but also desired side effects. And we want to screen the literature for these desired side effects. And we use textual features and evidences for the characterization of the drugs. The disadvantage, of course, is that we would need more access to full text. All that is largely based on PubMed or Medline abstracts. This is how chemists, actually, people in cheminformatics, represent chemistry. They have built fingerprints, what they call fingerprints, which is a representation format that typically builds on physicochemical features. So the question or the point whether there is a dimethyl substituted atom or an N-separated by two bonds and so on, those physicochemical features are encoded in a binary vector. There's a different type of fingerprint which also takes, for instance, the ring structures and so on, or donor and acceptor sites into account. This is how people usually in cheminformatics deal with descriptors of chemistry. We actually use textual features as descriptors. And what you see here is a compound name like timolol or digitoxin, And then a property term, this is the drug term here, propadyl nitrate or timolol or digitoxin is a drug name. Then you have the property term. What the property term basically describes what biological function this drug has. And then you have even relationships like instance relationships. Timolol is a beta adrenal receptor blocker. So this marks an instantiation, yeah? And this can be captured by so-called Hurst patterns. For those who are in computer linguistics, they are certainly familiar with that, which is actually a method or an approach to define this sort of regular expressions. And in our case, they express direct relationships between drugs and their properties. And we screened the entire literature for these sort of expressions. And Harsha was then mapping this to an ontology, which is an ontology widely used in biomedicine, the UMLS. He was also coming up with some terms that he could not map to the ontology, and we would not discard that information. We took it up in basically new classes of terms. So we expanded, or we have the option to expand the ontology. And then he was casting the entire thing in this feature vector. And this feature vector comprises all the UMLS terms plus additional terms, and you generate a profile for each compound over text features, okay? And then he was looking how and training for the known ATC classes. He was training a classifier based on the belonging or the already available classification for those compounds that were already known to belong to a certain class in ATC. And then he was using this model, this classifier, he would also select the most information-rich descriptors or features, but that is a side aspect. He would then use that on a set of drugs that have not yet been classified, and he tested that on a test set of 114 drugs where human experts actually did the classification based on expert knowledge. And it turned out, and that's the surprising or the striking finding of his master's thesis, that this text concept-based prediction or classification is outperforming by far the physicochemical or physicochemistry-based descriptors. That was surprising for us. That's quite encouraging. That means that the knowledge beans in scientific text have a higher predictive power for classification than the physicochemical properties, which are usually used in chem informatics. And the system, whenever it's not absolutely sure, you see that it's here doing a lot of true predictions, a very limited number of false predictions, and a significant number of no predictions, because it simply says, no, I have nothing where I could assign a class to this compound, which is quite encouraging, because those other methodologies here tend to ignore the problem that sometimes you cannot classify. Good. That was one thing, one example, how we use text for classification in chem informatics. Now, in a different master's thesis of Erfan Yunesi, another student in my group, who's also continuing his PhD now in my department, we used text mining approaches to identify whole gene networks involved in the susceptibility to breast cancer treatment. So the goal of this study was the identification of networks of proteins functionally linked to tumorigenesis of breast cancer, but also answering the question in how far those networks mediate susceptibility to clinical treatment and whether there are clinical treatment options which are linked to those networks and which are currently ignored by the clinical best practice. So what you see here is a sort of decision tree that is representing the diagnostic schema and clinical practice in breast cancer as executed currently, so not too many nodes in that, not too many decisions, and consequently only a few factors that the clinician makes the treatment decision up to, whether it's a lymph node affected or not by metastasizing cells, whether these cells are estrogen receptor positive or negative, and so on. The cooperativity between genes and proteins are not taken into account at all. So biology is not, and tumor biology is not seen as a system. It's seen as a very primitive system, just characterized by four factors or so. And that is current practice in hospitals. When you look into the literature, and this is a network that can be established in the literature just of proteins significantly associated with breast cancer, you see that this is way more complex than what the average clinician bases his decision on. But on the other side, you wouldn't like a clinician to base his decision on such a mess here. Okay? So you will have to bring that down to a reasonable size of a network. And this is a network which has been built on simple co-occurrences in text, so there's the little semantics in this, little relationships. What Erfan was doing was actually coming from this huge network down to a network of 13 factors, which are linked, as you see in this graph here. These are 13 genes, and their proteins are interacting partially. He did that by analyzing network topologies, connectivity of the network, also functional assignment and annotations of each individual node in the network, and so on. So a couple of filtering steps. And he associated those nodes, this 13-element network, with clinical outcome. And actually, he came up with 23 novel associations between this minimum gene set associated with breast cancer susceptibility and clinical outcome. And that does not mean now that we would be in the position to tell the clinicians you have to look after this or that. But these 23 novel associations are paving the way for new clinical studies. And the question is whether, let's say, in a study design, somebody would have come across these 23 novel associations without the help of text mining. I doubt that, because if we go back to this network here, this complexity cannot be really gathered and overseen by a single researcher. Now, and finally, I'm coming to the end with an outlook, what we are currently doing and what we will be doing in the next few weeks. And that is dealing with the chemistry side of things and information extraction from images. And actually, we are currently planning and preparing a grand challenge in computing in the area of patent mining. And that's something we do in a collaboration between the Fraunhofer side of my activities and the research center in Jülich, namely the supercomputing center in Jülich. The goal of this study is to just show that we can annotate really huge numbers, large numbers of full-text scientific text, namely patents. We want to show that supercomputers can be used for other stuff than numerical simulation of climate and weather, or crash simulations, or the Big Bang simulations, and so on. We can actually use them for knowledge computing. We want to demonstrate the enhancement of retrieval in the area of chemistry by the intelligent software, namely the ChemoCR chemical structure reconstruction that we have been building. And ultimately, we are aiming at using image mining to support mining in chemical IP at a large scale. Now, what is ChemoCR doing? It is taking PDF or any scanned document and normalizes it to a bitmap with 250 dpi grayscale. It's autonomously detecting chemistry in the PDF like this. It finds images and divides the world into contains chemistry and does not contain chemistry. So everything else is put aside. You see that this here is actually a synthesis schema. And the software recognizes that this is a synthesis schema, so it takes the entire thing, the entire chemical objects here, and generates one big element which comprises the entire chemical reaction schema, which is then handed over to the reconstruction module. And the reconstruction module is classifying characters and symbols in the image. It's detecting lines, bonds, characters, sends the characters to the OCR, is vectorizing the bonds, is distinguishing between double and triple bonds, single bonds, and so on. Has a lot of rules and chemical know-how and knowledge. So there's also an expert system behind that, which helps to interpret the image. And ultimately, it writes a chemical representation format. So it turns pixels into chemical knowledge. And that's the output format. And you can assemble entire chemical reactions with this software. And what we deal with, and that's just for you as you're mainly people involved in scientific information provisioning and organization and indexing and so on, just give you a couple of examples that I would like to share with you that give you an idea how the funny ways how chemists communicate make the life of a computer scientist more interesting. So sometimes, and I left the German comments by my coworker Mark Zimmermann, sometimes they use graphical elements which are not standard nomenclature and the semantics are unclear in these cases, or when you have these arrows which basically indicate that there is a sort of change in the intramolecular structure. We have very complex images, and the publishers obviously don't really care about the way how complex those images may be, because they always assume that the reader is a chemist, but sometimes the reader is a computer. And of course, we all know about the discussions to add proper meta information in the publishing process. But we are sitting on a huge amount of legacy information in the field of chemistry. So that can be quite demanding, as you see also here, where you have certain R groups which are indicated here in this schema, which belong here to this molecule and so on. You have strange objects in drawing elements, because this is quite a long bond here, as you see, or here these are really long bonds, whereas the standard bond length is like this, and that imposes a problem to our interpreter and the expert system. We have things like that where it's not any funny anymore, where the reconstruction software really runs into more demanding tasks. And ultimately, you have this complete craziness of images like this, and still people would like to retrieve patents or chemical journals and handbooks and so on based on a query that they ask actually by querying by example, or so by drawing a structure, and give me all the papers in which this element or that element or so is shown. Yeah. And we are not too far from being able to allow this sort of retrieval. You can actually now already retrieve patents and a couple of monographies by a chemical similarity search doing this. So, and with that outlook into the future, what we are doing now, I would like to acknowledge the contribution from a couple of students and scientists in my department. I'm afraid this list is not really complete, but that just shows how much work is behind what I told you just, and with that I finish. I'm happy to take questions.
So, thank you, Martin, for these insights beyond text. Other questions?
I'm Lee Starr from the University of British Columbia in Canada. I'm assuming that you're doing most of your searching against full-text databases. Is that correct?
The playground for most biomedical text mining people is the PubMed, the abstract collection in Medline. That's where you, basically we have our sandbox and playground. We are now working, as I said, more with patent literature, and sometimes we have downloaded open access full text, but the current open access terms of use exclude machine-based mining, which is a real drawback. To be clear and frank about that, I mean we really need to allow the machines to work on text and to extract whatever is in there. And I would, of course, extend that to, let's say, all the Elsevier stuff that's older than 5 years or so. I want to have that.
So that was actually my question. You think results would in fact be better if you were able to mine the full text of a journal?
Yeah, there's actually, from Marty Hurst, there's a paper stating that you get already quite a significant amount of information, relevant information from the abstracts. So abstracts are really extremely rich in relevant information. But when it comes to quantitative values, or when you look at, of course, the images I've just shown, the chemical depictions are all in the full text and not in the abstract. So that is just one example in one particular domain. But I guess there's also other domains where you just really depend on table parsing, on images, on whenever it's turning into quantitative things. And so I think ultimately, yeah, we need full text access.
Thank you.
And if you help to overcome the roadblocks, I appreciate that.
Herbert van der Sompel, Los Alamos National Laboratory. I think this is extremely fascinating work. Since you do a lot of text mining and comparison between extracted information, you clearly will deal with uncertainties. I mean, there is an error margin involved in this. So I guess for every little piece you extract, you have something like a trustworthiness factor. Which in most text mining initiatives you will see. Now, we're kind of used to that, but when it comes to medical applications, as the ones you suggest, the consequences may eventually be a bit dire, so of mistakes, I mean. So I wonder how, in your approach, you deal with those kind of problems.
Thanks for that question. It's a very relevant point. So basically, our confidence values we compute now for each co-occurrence or so are based on statistics, which is not the best way to do it. If we could add the or compute a more complex quality score, which is taking into account like bibliometric factors, like relationship mining. True statement, I mean, evidences that are supported by independent groups publishing independent, so that where you have the author information and the network of people who publish together and so on taken into account. So in natural sciences, it's easier to look for confirmatory evidences which come from independent labs. That would be a quality means. That is all interesting work lying ahead of us, I'm afraid. We didn't solve that problem, but that's something which could also come from your community more, because you're so much in citation networks and all that. And there's one more thing with the medical evidences. I mean, it's absolutely clear that everything that we do in this medical evidence parsing project, where we chase the or where we mine the literature for something that could go into a provide or that could encode a medical evidence, that has to be reviewed by an expert before it is considered for any use in a medical textbook. That's clear. So we're not letting the machines replace the experts. It's just that the work of the experts is made much more efficient through machines like the reading machines.
Okay, thanks again, Martin.